Welcome to the Florida Roundup here on Florida Public Radio. Thanks for listening this week. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. Well, the impeachment inquiry swirling around President Donald Trump has Florida connections. Two South Florida men, Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman, both associates of the president's personal lawyer, Rudy Giuliani, have both been charged with federal campaign finance violations. They were arrested Wednesday trying to board a one-way flight to Vienna. Now, prosecutors say these men had key roles in Giuliani's freelance efforts to launch an independent Ukrainian corruption investigation against Democratic presidential contender Joe Biden and his son, Hunter.
Now, the two men also personally donated at least $281,000 to Republicans in Florida and across the country. This includes to Florida Governor Ron DeSantis. The governor says he's returning their $50,000 campaign donation. And on Monday this week, pictures and some video surfaced showing DeSantis with Parnas at his election night party last November. This week also, a fourth man was arrested in this case. David Coria lives in Palm Beach Gardens in Palm Beach County. He's a business partner with Parnas and is accused of working to funnel foreign money to U.S. political campaigns.
There are lots of tentacles to this story and the Florida connection to the impeachment inquiry involving the president and actors in Ukraine. In a moment, we're going to go to your calls. What are your questions about this? Call us up from wherever you are in the state. The number to join the Florida Roundup, 305-995-1800. You can tweet us at Florida Roundup. We're going to begin the discussion now with Emily Mahoney. She covers Florida government for the Tampa Bay Times and the Miami Herald. And she's been looking at the Florida connections to the Ukraine scandal. Emily's with us from WFSU in Tallahassee. Emily, thanks for joining us. So what do we know so far about Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman and their activities here in Florida?
Hi. Well, thanks so much for having me. That's a great question. And the amount of information that we have continues to grow basically every day. And that's one of the reasons why this story is so interesting, is because Florida was not mentioned in the initial indictment of Parnas and Fruman that came out of New York, whereas other states that they were involved in, like Nevada, were. So everything that we know so far has really just been coming out piece by piece in media reports. And so what we do know is, like you said, that they donated $50,000 to Ron DeSantis's campaign that came through this kind of shady Delaware corporation that in the indictment was said to have been funneling money from overseas, which is illegal. They also lobbied a Florida congressman, or now a former Florida congressman, Carlos Cubello from Miami, about getting into Florida's emerging medical marijuana industry. And that's an important point because we've been trying to figure out their motivation and their interest in Florida. And the Miami Herald reported earlier this week that they had also been seeking to get a license or invest in Florida's medical marijuana industry as well. So that gives us a clue as to what they were financially trying to get at here. But there's still a lot that we're still reporting on and a lot still to learn.
Yeah, there's some evidence that they were interested in the marijuana industry in Nevada as well as here in Florida. Emily, how would you describe their business dealings in Florida? What kind of business were they in?
Well, they had, at least Parnas had co-founded a business down in Boca Raton that was supposed to help investors be protected against scams. It was called Fraud Guarantee. They, you know, just recently in the New York court hearings, the prosecutors revealed that they are looking at 50 bank accounts. You know, they were said to have set up a lot of different companies. So it's hard to kind of define that under one umbrella, but they certainly had a lot going on. They left kind of a trail of lawsuits behind, of jilted business partners and things like that. So there was a lot of money moving around. The sources are unclear, but based on the indictment, you know, we believe that some of it was coming from an unidentified foreign national who was probably Russian.
It's 305-995-1800 as we talk about the Florida connections to the Ukraine scandal and the impeachment inquiry against President Trump. As you've reported, Emily, there's a lot of money to trace. These men also received payments from a lobbying firm with clout both here in Florida and in Washington, Ballard Partners, client referrals, apparently. Your outlet, the Tampa Bay Times, also is publishing new video of these men hugging Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, who has worked hard to distance himself from these two now suspects. He said he's giving back the donations they gave him. Senator Rick Scott, other prominent Republican politicians in the state say they will also donate back funds they receive from Parnas and Fruman. As the national and even the global story plays out, what can we glean from these campaign contributions these men made to prominent GOP players here in Florida, the type of access they were seeking, and if there will be any blowback on the Republican leadership here in the state as this investigation unfolds?
Right. Well, and I think that's a really central question. I mean, nobody donates this kind of money just out of pure altruism, right? Everybody has something that they're looking for. And so the question here has been, what were they looking for and what kind of access were they trying to get, and did they get it? And one of the things that has struck me about this so far, like you said, they were hugging the governor at the election night party, but they were also clearly standing in the way of the TV cameras when Governor DeSantis was answering questions from reporters on election night about his victory. So on one hand, you know, DeSantis has his answers about this have kind of evolved from first saying that there was no relationship with them at all as to 2 days ago. He said that he did know Parnas and that they, you know, he was just a normal donor, that he saw at a lot of Trump events. But on the other hand, I think it's also important to acknowledge that these men appear to have been seeking to cultivate the image that they were well connected, and they were clearly trying to be seen with the governor in many different ways, both in fundraisers and at this election night party. So it's a question of like how much of this was just them cultivating that image because it helped them perhaps profit on that access and selling that access, and how much access did they actually get?
What do we know about the sources of the funds that prosecutors say were foreign contributions, illegal foreign contributions to political campaigns? Where did the money come from?
We don't know a whole lot yet, but what we do know comes from the indictment, and it essentially says it came from an unidentified foreign national with Russian ties. So we're still working on that. Obviously, that's not completely clear.
Yeah, and speaking of Russia, something that's worth mentioning with this Ukraine inquiry, these associates of Mr. Giuliani from Florida were apparently engaged in not only trying to pressure the Ukrainian government to investigate Joe and Hunter Biden, but also to try to bring credibility to a debunked conspiracy theory that it was Ukraine that hacked the Democratic National Committee in 2016 and attempted to influence the 2016 election. That's not true. It was Russia. So let's go to some calls now on this as we speak with Emily Mahoney of the Tampa Bay Times. What are your questions about the Florida connection to the Ukraine scandal and the impeachment inquiry? Thomas is in Orlando. It's 305-995-1800 to join us. Hi, Thomas. Thanks for calling. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Yes, good day, ma'am. I think this is a very good discussion. You know, we're addressing a lot of the issues, you know, across the board with the investigations. My particular question is how are we supposed to look? You know, I've been on both sides, you know, supportive, you know, I mean, we look at Democratic and we look at the Republican Party. How are we supposed to look at the Republican Party in the aftermath of such investigations when we see that, you know, foreign interference and foreign funds are being utilized and funneled into the American political system?
Okay. Thank you for that. Thanks for that call. Emily Mahoney, as you've been careful to point out, this investigation is ongoing. There's a lot more to be gleaned. But that said, these Ukrainian nationals were certainly seeking to gain influence in the highest levels of Republican politics, both here in Florida and nationally. And so how does that redound, you know, to the national inquiry looking at impeachment of the president?
Well, and I think the caller makes a good point about how, you know, what the kind of the political implications of this really are. And, you know, it's important to note that in the indictment, it lays out that the candidates, they don't have evidence that the candidates knew that this money had, you know, illegal foreign origins. But also is important to point out that Florida is handling this differently than Nevada has been, for example. And I think that's an interesting contrast. In Nevada, after the indictment came out and, you know, it was discovered that these two men were trying to invest in their marijuana industry, the governor launched an investigation, a state investigation of that and, you know, kind of how this happened. And we haven't seen that same attitude in Florida. And, you know, like I said, we just recently found out that marijuana was kind of part of the equation here in Florida.
Yeah.
And the only reason we know that is because of reporting by reporters and not by information that's coming from the government.
Emily, let me ask you about the connections to the governor, because over the weekend and early this week, the governor's spokesperson was putting a lot of distance between Governor DeSantis and the two gentlemen that were arrested and indicted in New York. And then there was found the $50,000 contribution. And then we started to see some photographic and video evidence that at least two of them, if not all three of them, had been in the same room together and interacted
and
together.
And didn't you report, Emily, that Parnas hosted an intimate fundraiser for Governor DeSantis, too? A small group?
Mm-hmm, correct. Yeah. So Parnas was involved in hosting two fundraisers, we believe, one of which was a pretty small affair with 30 or fewer people, the Herald has reported. And so, you know, like I said, this is continuing to evolve. DeSantis a couple days ago said that he did know them, which like you have noted, was kind of a different tone than we had heard from previous statements. But that he was just another donor. They have said that they had not had one-on-one meetings, or that, you know, these guys were not part of creating any kind of master strategy for the governor or anything, but that they were simply supporting him. But they clearly, you know, gained some level of access because they had these fundraisers and they were at his election night party. So they were certainly on the governor's radar.
Hmm. Mm-hmm. So at the same time all this is happening, we learned yesterday that the G7 conference next year will be held, the White House has decided, at Trump Doral, just west of Miami International Airport, one of the largest contributing financial pieces of the Trump business that's run by the sons of the president. And it has brought up additional questions about, obviously, influence and presidential decision making. Joe on line three has a comment around that. Joe from Melbourne, welcome to the program. Go ahead.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking the call. Good afternoon. I, having been retired now from public service after 40 years and serving as a Marine, I wanted to share that in 2012, I worked for the VA for 8 months as a consular. And I was refused. I was literally told I could not buy a cup of coffee for a homeless 85-year-old Korean veteran because it would have been seen as fraternizing. And I can't imagine how public servants from the lowest level to the highest must feel when they see a president can essentially solicit business to his family. It is discouraging to me, and I imagine it is to other public servants. So just wanted to share that.
Joe, I appreciate that comment there from Melbourne. Certainly, there's lots of questions regarding the decision-making process that the White House has used to locate the G7 conference next year in Doral. But Emily Mahoney with the Tampa Bay Times and Miami Herald, what about the Florida Republican Party, not only in the conversation and questions regarding the two Ukrainian and Belarus individuals and the foreign campaign contributions allegations, but also then, of course, this story coming out late yesterday about the G7 coming to Doral. I mean, is the Florida Republican Party putting out much communications in regards to this?
Well, we did hear yesterday Governor DeSantis tweeted after the news about G7 broke that he was excited for the conference to happen in Florida, and that it, you know, kind of basically touting it as an opportunity for Florida to showcase itself as a destination and a place where important world leaders would gather. And obviously that kind of leaves out a lot of the
any
other
criticism,
important
yeah.
conversations.
Yeah, I mean, it's important to note, too, there are multiple lawsuits ongoing addressing the president's, critics say, repeated violations of the Emoluments Clause. It's against the law for a sitting president to take any gifts of monetary value from a foreign country to personally profit. Trump Doral is also is a money-losing property, and it's one of the few that isn't just where he has licensed his name, but that he owes a lot of money on. So that provides some context, too. Before we get to the break, I'd like to get some emails and tweets on the air from listeners all over the state regarding the governor's potential connections to the two Ukrainian men from South Florida. Tom in Jacksonville emails us and says, even if what DeSantis says is true, he effectively received an interest-free $50,000 loan for his campaign. That means there is no disincentive to accepting sleazy money. Here's another tweet from Amy. Really, one phone call would have told him these guys were foreign operatives and up to no good. Emily, this whole scandal, which now has its tentacles here in Florida, is giving life to the narrative in this state that it's the Wild West when it comes to political contributions. Both parties have been accused of less than savory dealings there. But what about the feedback we're getting from listeners on all of that?
Well, I think one of the biggest takeaways from this is just another reminder of, you know, how closely our Governor DeSantis was tied with President Trump in all of his kind of political rise here in Florida. And of course, that's obvious. I mean, that was something that really, I think, caused a lot of voters to vote for him. But it's also just as this impeachment inquiry develops and we learn all of these new details about, the president's and Giuliani's ties overseas and all of this money going around, that it's inevitable that the Governor DeSantis, will have to be part of that conversation because he shared so many of the same supporters and donors in this case.
Emily, mm-hmm. What kind of responsibility do the candidates or the campaigns have in knowing the source of those donations? And I asked that question. There was a local politician here in South Florida that was caught taking foreign contributions, was kind of banned from politics for a while, and now serves in the legislature.
Right. Well, and that's been another piece of this conversation, basically. And when I've talked to a lot of Republicans, kind of as this has unfolded, they have said, it's not only not right, but it's just unfair to ask a candidate to really be able to vet all of their donors as a campaign is ramping up, especially a campaign as big as one for Florida governor, where we're talking about millions and millions of dollars coming in all the time. And people, and you just have to kind of smile and shake hands and meet people. And it doesn't mean that you are best friends with them if you appear in a photo with them. And so, I think that seems to have merit. I think that, that is the nature of campaigning, mm-hmm. honestly. I mean, that from what I've seen. I think the fact that when they did learn about this, they returned it does say something, because they're acknowledging that they made a mistake in accepting it in the first place. But there has been discussion about Senator Tom Lee. When I talked to him about this, he was saying maybe we need to create a system.
Speaking of him, he's joining the show in just a moment. And I need to jump in and thank Emily Mahoney.
Different topic,
though. Yeah, on another topic. Emily Mahoney of the Tampa Bay Times and Miami Herald, thanks for being with us. We appreciate
Thanks
you joining
so
us. In a moment, speaking of a topic change, climate change in Florida. That's next here on Florida Public Radio. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. Thanks for being with us this Friday. I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville.
And I'm Tom Hudson in Miami. Back in the spring of 2015, the head of Florida's Emergency Management Agency found himself testifying before a Senate Budget Subcommittee. Brian Kuhn was discussing the process to get federal money to help improve emergency awareness ahead of floods and hurricanes.
My understanding is at this point is it will require that future versions of our mitigation plan will be required to have language discussing that issue.
What issue is that?
The issue that you mentioned earlier regarding
climate. All right.
So much.
Wow. Listen to that laughter. That's because at the time, Kuhn would not say the phrase climate change. State agencies were banned from using the term here in Florida as recently as 4 years ago. Today, while not saying climate change exactly, this week a Florida Republican state senator kicked off a committee hearing by saying this.
We wanted to kick off a conversation here today about sea level rise.
Republican Senator Tom Lee from the Tampa area admitted state lawmakers have lost a decade in dealing with the effects of climate change and planning for rising seas.
A lot of my colleagues that I've sat with over time, I've referred to as sort of, they just sort of emotionally shut down when you begin to have this conversation.
So we're having that conversation here today on the Florida Roundup. Why is sea level rise on the GOP agenda now? What shape is it in on that agenda? What could it mean for your neighborhood? And is your town experiencing the effects of higher seas and hotter days and hotter nights? Let us know. Share your experiences with us and your questions. 305-995-1800. Statewide, 305-995-1800. Or the handle on Twitter is at Florida Roundup. Senator Lee joins us now on the Florida Roundup. Senator, welcome. Thanks for your time today.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
In your remarks this week, you said that you understood why the issue of sea level rise had not been discussed in the past. Why? Why hadn't it been discussed?
Well, I think, you know, politics in America has become hyper-partisan. And, you know, I've been around the legislature. I first elected the Senate in the mid-90s, and it was a much different time here in our state with the advent of social media and the echo chambers that have developed around that social media. People pick sides a lot more today than they think about policy. And I think that this is such a daunting undertaking to get your head around the magnitude of implications associated with sea level rise, that there were people that didn't want to slow down long enough to do it, and there were other people that when they slowed down long enough to do it, they questioned the potential they might have, the ability they would have to do anything about it, given the magnitude of it. And then there's a third group, I guess, that the consequences are so dramatic if these predictions do bear out, it's just economically daunting. I mean, you have to be the grim reaper of reality in a world that is isn't real fond of the grim reaper. So it's, you know, that's why I use the term emotionally shut down, because I think they just you lose people at hello a lot of times in a Republican conversation over this. But I think over time what has happened is the evidence has just continued to mount, and the reality of the sea level rise is just hard for people to ignore. And if we can get away from the conversation about, you know, was Al Gore right, or who took the lead on this, or are we really going to be here in 12 years, and start focusing prospectively on what are we going to do about this.
Let me ask you about that, Senator Lee. Melissa Ross here in Jacksonville.
Sure,
a lot of attention given to the Republican gathering in Tallahassee, where some participants lamented that Florida has lost an entire decade in figuring out a comprehensive, strategic, long-range plan for dealing with climate change and sea level rise. And so we are the state that's perhaps most vulnerable in the nation to these impacts, given all of our miles of coastline, our semi-tropical climate. We're looking at rising seas, hotter temperatures, more flooding, more extreme weather events. Even bankers now are weighing in with new reports about the impact to real estate in Florida. Home values could fall significantly. There is just a parade of horribles related to all this. And so you gave a really good summation of why this has been a difficult topic for legislators to take on. But what's your response to those listening, particularly young people? They've been marching and protesting all over the world. They're angry about how slow Florida has been to respond to this, given that it's going to become a critically important issue to tackle in the coming years. What's your answer to those folks who think that willfully denying science because of partisanship, well, you know, was irresponsible?
Well, you look, that's the danger in looking back is that, you know, there's nothing I can say. I will tell you, there's nothing I can say that is going to change the events in, of history. We are where we are today. I will tell you that while the politicians may have been spending their time focused on other things and have not been taking advantage of this last decade to advance policies in preparation for the future, there's been a lot of work, and this came out during our committee, done by the administration, which was kind of almost funny because, you know, the things the politicians weren't wanting to talk about were actually being ignored by the planners and engineers whose job it is to implement our five-year work program in the Department of Transportation. Now, the data they were using is not the same data that some of the environmental community is using or the scientists are using, but there was planning going on inside the Department of Transportation. We had two professionals testify. One was a planner, the other was an engineer. And, you know, so while the politicians weren't talking about it, the professionals inside the agencies were actually doing some planning around it. But I've had a tendency to, you know, look more prospectively to think that, you know, these younger people are electing younger elected officials. Governor DeSantis is 40 years old, and he has hired a resiliency officer who testified in our committee about this. The incoming Speaker of the House is about the same age, and in his address at the Republican caucus when he was designated as the next speaker, he too pointed out that we need to deal with climate change.
Yeah,
so
Senator,
I think you're seeing younger people coming in to take this issue up.
Yeah, you talk about some of the changing demographics and the younger demographics really beginning to bend the needle on this when it comes to the Republican legislature, Republican-led legislature. One of your colleagues in the Senate, Jose Javier Rodriguez, is along with us now, a Democrat representing parts of Miami. Senator Rodriguez, welcome back to Florida Public Radio. How significant is this conversation being led by Republican Senator Lee discussing sea level rise at an infrastructure committee meeting of a Senate committee?
Well, first of all, thanks for having us on, and great to be with you indirectly, Senator Lee. I'll see you soon in Tallahassee. So I think it's significant. I would dispute that that climate change was not discussed. I think it was discussed, and I think that it is significant. I think that from my vantage point, you know, I've been wearing big black rubber rain boots. This is the third legislative session. You know, since I got elected, there's been a group of us trying to push and push and push. And I got frustrated because there were just even small incremental changes. Nothing was happening. So, I started wearing these things and just, you know, really trying to meet with every element of our, you know, state government to try to see where we could move the needle for transformative change on the issue of climate. It is an issue that affects, you know, every aspect, you know, so many other aspects. It's not a separate topic that's separate. So I do think it's significant because it wasn't just talking about climate. We did end up talking also about the causes, right, which was, frankly, our energy policy. And I thought that it was a very open and good discussion. And I think that, to be perfectly honest, you know, I think that my hope is that we can take aggressive and transformative policy action this legislative session coming up in early 2020, because, you know, for me, you know, the lost decade that Senator Lee describes sets the bar unbelievably low. I mean, I'll just be perfectly honest with you. It is not acceptable to heap praise on the incoming Speaker of the House just for saying climate change. I mean, goodness. Since the 80s,
but
the
it's a big change from 2015
settled, right?
When you heard the chief emergency manager unable to say climate change in front of a subcommittee.
It's true. So Senator Lee just, you know, is totally right. There was a hostility for a decade to dealing with climate, and that was not true. And he's also true that it wasn't partisan. Whatever 10, 15 years ago, there were actually things that we were moving forward on. And
so, Senator, you know, Rodriguez, Melissa Ross here. What policy changes do you believe Florida should be looking at? As just one example, we could talk about. In the last week or so, it was reported that vehicle emissions in the state of Florida are up sharply. Florida has no emission testing program. That was done away with during the Jeb Bush administration, is my understanding. And so There are a lot of policy prescriptions to reducing carbon emissions. That's just one of them. That's one piece of the puzzle. The other is figuring out adaptation and mitigation efforts for our very vulnerable state. And so can common ground be found in the state legislature, given that the two parties aren't really on the same page about what we need to do about climate change?
I think so. I'll try to maybe hit 4 points as quickly as I can. When it comes to energy policy, we need to completely change how we do energy, right? So I think that I don't have a lot of faith in movement from the legislature soon. The utilities really do have a monopoly and a lockdown on a lot of policymaking in Tallahassee. But when it comes to a lot of the energy proposals that we have to try to promote solar, promote renewables, one of the things in meeting with the governor's office this week is an openness to really advance electric vehicles. Now, that's a piece of the puzzle. It frankly is not a very large piece of the puzzle, but it does go a long way to put us in a stronger footing. So that's one thing I would say. In dealing with the effects of climate, I'll actually say Senator Lee and his committee last year passed out one of the two bills that are really important to me and that I think are significant. It didn't pass in the House, but what the bill does is it says that if you are building in the coastal zone with state taxpayer dollars, you have to plan for sea level rise. Very simple. Everybody gets behind it. Not complicated. The other bill that I think is important is it's requiring kind of a threat assessment annually on our public health system from climate. I have really, the more I learn about the impacts of on public health and human health of climate, the more I'm convinced that the way that most Floridians will first encounter climate change, other than a king tide or something like that in a real way, is potentially through human health. And so I think we really ought to reorient a lot of what we're doing on the public health sector to take into consider that.
Senator Lee, I want to have you kind of respond to what you're hearing from your fellow Senator Rodriguez, but I want to remind folks, first of all, that you are listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Senator Tom Lee, Republican from the Tampa area, when you hear your Democratic colleague in the Senate talk about some of these legislative ideas, encouraging electric vehicles, maybe a small piece of the energy pie, but also addressing requirements, mandating requirements to have developers take into account sea level rise building upon the coastline, what kind of chance could those have in your Senate chamber this upcoming session?
Well, I think, first of all, welcome, Jose. It's always good to be with you. He's right. He wore these boots to session, and I first thought he was wearing them because there's so much horse manure up here in Tallahassee.
I'll share with everybody. He's got them on today in Miami, and it's 90-some-odd degrees
what
outside.
What color are they? Are they photo?
They're black.
They're black boots. Okay, I'm trying to get a visual up here in Jacksonville. Okay.
Right. Listen, I'll have a more provocative color, neon green, if it'll get a bill passed. But
they're old-fashioned rubber boots, and so... Anyway, we've had a number of conversations, he and I, about this over time. And, you know, the reason I thought it was really important that the incoming speaker talked about this is because they spend time talking about two or three things that are going to be important to them while they're speaker. And when they say those words, typically they become the priorities of their administration over history. And so by mentioning this, it kind of sent a signal to all of us that perhaps he would spend a fair amount of political capital to try to advance this issue over his 2 years as speaker, which starts in 2021 session. So having said that, I think that, you know, where we have some work to do because we are in our infancy. We have a climate officer that has been appointed by the governor, and she is just getting her head around the magnitude of this. She's met with a ton of people, and she's going to be coming back with some recommendations. And the thing that jumped out at me initially was the disconnect between, is it 6 inches or is it 4 feet? And it seems like the industry, if you will, scientists are settling somewhere around the 2 foot level. Are you going to use a linear approach, or are you going to consider the amplifying effect of these greenhouse emissions as they increase? So I think that's the first thing. We have to have a target. You know, our primary goal was to take the position that you know, we're responsible for infrastructure. We're putting tens of millions of dollars in the ground every year, billions of dollars in the ground a year for assets that are going to be worth, have a life expectancy of 50 or 100 years. We ought to be building them at an elevation.
Right. Why not be planning now for managed retreat, figuring out how to move some people
inland?
Right, but you
got to know what you're planning toward. Right. And so we're working on all of that right now. On the point about, well, so is there anything we could do to mitigate and stop the bleeding, if you will, that as this situation gets worse? And I think that I agree with my colleague that electric vehicles is probably the place beyond, you know, trying to get our head around, you know, what is the target here for sea level rise? Electric vehicles is probably the place where we can have the greatest immediate impact. They are causing the greatest amount of the problem.
Emissions from vehicles.
And so I've actually been working on something that I'm going to probably be talking to him about here shortly. That came to me through some friends I have in different walks of life around the state over the years to try to advance electric vehicle recharging facility policy, maybe similar to something that he's been working on. Maybe we can work on it together.
You could work on it in the next 10 minutes here on public radio if the two of the senators would like to do that and do it fully in the sunshine, Senator Lee. Well, stick with us, though, Senator Lee. We got to take a quick break as Senator Rodriguez here talking about climate change and sea level rise. Senator Tom Lee along with us, Republican from the Tampa area. Jose Javier Rodriguez, a Democrat senator from Miami. Your phone calls 305-995-1800 or at Florida Roundup. Are you seeing the effect of climate change in your neighborhood? What questions do you have for these leading senators as they tackle the issue, perhaps in the upcoming legislative session? 305-995-1800. It's all ahead on the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here today on Florida Public Radio. Thanks again for listening. I'm Tom Hudson in Miami.
And I'm Melissa Ross in Jacksonville. And as we continue talking about Florida coming to grips with climate change here on the show today with Senators Tom Lee and Jose Javier Rodriguez, it's important to note that this week, Acting White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney told reporters that climate change will not be on the agenda for the G7 summit next year, which will be held controversially at the Trump National in Doral, Florida. And so that leads us into the next phase of this discussion, Florida and the nation's climate change politics. Brendan Rivers is our lead environmental reporter at WJCT in Jacksonville and also the lead contributor to our digital magazine, looking at the impacts of climate change in Florida. You can check it out at adaptflorida.org. Brendan, thanks for being with us. Hey.
Happy to be here.
Now, you recently attended a conference in Nashville, the Inside Climate News Fellowship, and you had a lot of conversations with other environmental journalists from around the Southeast, giving you a bit of a perspective on our politics of climate change here in Florida. What did you learn from that experience?
Well, there seemed to be a couple key differences based on what I was hearing from those other journalists. One that really comes to mind was a writer for Alabama.com. And so basically what he and some of the others were telling me was when they write stories and they talk about climate change and the focus of the story is climate change, they tend to get a lot of pushback. And I don't feel like, I mean, maybe it's just because we're public media, who knows? And our readers, our listeners understand that this is happening, but they get a lot of pushback. And it seems like in those states, the state leaders aren't really dealing with this. Whereas in Florida, as you're hearing from the conversation that you just had, they are starting to talk about this and starting to deal with it.
And that is because I would guess here in Florida, the evidence is right in front of our eyes. You can't deny it anymore, right?
Exactly. I think in Florida, no one lives more than 60 miles from the coast. And sea level rise is happening everywhere, but it's concentrated in the southeast United States. It's happening faster in this area than any other part of the country. So you can't help but see it. You can't avoid it, especially in areas like Miami. They're getting however many sunny day flooding events a year. It's happening here in Jacksonville now, and it's happening more frequently.
Yeah, Senator Rodriguez, that's why you wear the boots, isn't it? To try to get people to pay attention. Sunny day flooding in South Florida, which is making its way up here to North Florida, No part of this state will be untouched by these impacts.
Yeah, you know, you're absolutely right. One of the things about the Sunny Day flooding and the King Tides, those of us who grew up in this community, this never used to happen, right? And so, you know, again, as I think, you know, Senator Lee was talking about the emotional factor, the daunting, that's all true. And I think what's overcome that is the fact that it is no longer deniable. And, you know, part of the way I look at it is it used to be a sort of an environmental issue, right? Climate change and something kind of distant. And as it's gotten in our face more and more, it's clear that it is also an economic issue. It is also an issue of our public health. It's becoming, if not already in many communities, a justice issue as well. And so, you know, it's something that we can't deny. And as you say, you know, one of the things that we talked about last year, and I think one of the reasons we were able to get some movement, although we weren't able to get that bill passed, was that, you know, credit markets are watching us as a state. These big insurance modeling companies, you know, the Cayman Islands and Switzerland, they have been watching us for a while, and they're starting to send us signals that if we don't get our act together, it's going to hurt us. And when it hurts us, what we're talking about is local governments, local economies, pocketbooks, property values. And I think people are getting that message, and that is spurring people to action that normally otherwise wouldn't want to tackle a problem, as Senator Lee describes, as daunting and as far-reaching as making sure that we're prepared for the current.
Yeah, we're getting tweets about that. People asking, with this being such a big problem, what will the insurance companies do? Will they stop insuring houses? Senator Lee, real estate in Florida, that's going to be a big driver of how our economy fares in this age of a warming planet. This is a state built on real estate, after all.
No question about it. All of that is true. And I grew up in the real estate business. I've been in the home building industry for 35 years. And despite all the improvements that we've made in energy efficiency in homes and what have you, and a lot of work has been done at the state and federal level, we're still faced with this, you know, issue of having to deal with the realities of the sea level coming up. And so, you know, I think that when this starts hitting us in the pocketbook, it'll get more people's attention for sure. And politicians have a tendency to live in the present. They get elected on short-term intervals. And what you did 50 years ago, you're not going to be here 50 years from now.
Yeah.
So they focus on things in the moment. And it makes it more difficult to get their attention. But I think that's starting to happen. And my colleague is absolutely correct. The credit markets, the underwriters, the lenders who are providing the capital and the equity, the debt equity and the capital to invest in these coastal communities are beginning to take note of the sea level rise and the long-term implications. So elevation levels are changing, but it's far more significant than just what happens at the coast. As a developer and a home builder, I can tell you that the level of porousness that our state has is going to deteriorate over time as we get saltwater intrusion and the water table rises.
Yeah.
That means all these retention ponds are going to be less capable of holding the stormwater runoff they've been designed to hold as we get these more dramatic rain events.
Yeah, we've got several phone calls, some tweets we'd like to get on the air and have the senators and Brendan, you respond to. Let me remind folks that you are listening to the Florida Roundup from Florida Public Radio. All right, line 8 in Tallahassee. Kim, you are on the radio. Go ahead, Kim.
Hi, yes. I'd like to ask Senator Lee. Senator Rodriguez mentioned that he'd like to see a transformative energy policy and come out of Tallahassee, and I think the majority of Floridians that I work with do as well. How far can you get? Of course, electric vehicles are great, but that does put additional pressure on the system, and we need to be transforming to renewable energy. How far can we get this session?
Well, I don't know. You know, there are three pieces of this puzzle, and one is the executive branch, the governor's office, the other is the House and the Senate. And as far as the Senate goes, I intend to try to move the needle on. I get a sense that Senator Rodriguez has a proposal that's fairly similar to something that I've been talking about that would allow the Public Service Commission and perhaps working with the Ag Commissioner to develop a electric vehicle recharging facility site plan for our state so that, that we could make sure that there's adequate recharging facilities on our roadways as an encouragement for people to transition from traditional gasoline powered vehicles mm-hmm. to electric vehicles.
But how important though is it the source of that energy? While the vehicles may be transitioning to electricity, that energy, the fuel source for generating that electricity, could still be in this state natural gas. It's still a fossil
that
fuel.
That still generates emissions. Yeah.
That's right. That's right. And I am not an expert on what's been done over the last so many years on renewable energy here in the state of Florida. I know that a lot of the investor-owned utilities in the state have large projects that they're developing throughout the state with solar and some with wind to try to transition us away from the traditional fuel sources that we've used. We've moved away from largely from coal over time. We now have scrubbers and things of that nature that, you know, further clean the energy. But moving an industry away from fuel diversity and the choices
it's like turning an ocean liner around. I just want to jump in since we're almost out of time, gentlemen. I want to quickly bring in Brendan Rivers before we go away. Brendan, you're covering this. The American Flood Coalition is hosting its first ever Florida Mayors Summit next week in Washington. 19 mayors from all over the state are going to hear from experts about the urgent issue of flooding and sea level rise. They're very concerned about this in Florida, of course.
Yeah. And as you said, 19 mayors, they represent about 2.5 million people in Florida. And if you look at this list of mayors, they're pretty much all from coastal communities. And that's because that's where you're seeing the impacts of climate change first. That's where you're seeing sea level rise infiltrate just neighborhoods on a regular basis. So they're part of this event. They're going to go talk to a bunch of federal experts about climate change, sea level rise, flooding. They're going to meet with the members of the American Flood Coalition, which is this bipartisan organization, so Republicans and Democrats who are trying to address these issues. And Dr. Neshawat, our state's first chief resilience officer, is going to be there as well.
Will
to talk
be there
about
as
all
well.
Issues.
They need practical information. These are municipal problems they've got to deal with.
Yeah.
So important and timely that that's happening.
Yeah, they got to answer to their residents, and their residents are seeing this firsthand.
Yeah, particularly in South Florida, Senator Rodriguez, as you've been pointing out, but Senator Lee, it's of concern to constituencies all over the state. And so as we close out this program, I want to thank both of you so much for joining us. Senator Tom Lee, Republican, Senator Jose Javier Rodriguez, a Democrat, both focusing heavily now on the impacts of climate change and sea level rise in Florida. And also with us, WJCT's own environmental reporter, Brendan Rivers. Thanks to you as well. Thanks to all three of you for appearing today.
Thank you.
And so much
Absolutely.
To talk about. You know, Tom, we could talk about this all day. I can't think of a more important issue long term for the state of Florida than this. So it's good to get this feedback from all of them.
And that's why the news this week was so significant with Senator Lee, the Republican, a Republican leader in the Senate, really putting the focus on sea level rise, even at the infrastructure level, as he mentions, because the state of Florida spends tens of billions of dollars of taxpayer money each year on lots of infrastructure projects around coastlines, roads and bridges and other kinds of projects where it becomes an economic issue. And
that's
so
right.
As the legislature moves into January, this certainly will be a place to watch.
Well, that's our show. The Florida Roundup, produced by WJCT Public Media in Jacksonville, WLRN Public Media in Miami. Heather Schatz and Denise Royal are producers.
Jason Zabka is the WLRN Director of Radio Programming, our technical director this hour. The Director of Radio Operations at WLRN is Peter Mertz. Engineering help from Charles Michaels and Brady Corum. Our theme music provided by Miami jazz guitarist Aaron Libos at aaronlibos.com. Have a great weekend. I'm Tom Hudson.
And I'm Melissa Ross. We'll be back next Friday at noon. See you then.